Fine. Okay, that's marvelous. Okay, so we started this sutta, session 1 and 2, in March. So about 10 months ago, yeah? So we are in the middle of the sutta. Were you here, Huitong? No. This was 10 months ago. We started this one. Anyway, probably nobody can remember, but we have started this one before. And so I will just give you a quick review of what this was about, yeah? So that you have some idea what this is about. This is the very first sutta in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourse of the Buddha. It is known as the Brahmajala Sutta. Brahmajala literally means Brahma's net. Yeah, and so the idea with this particular sutta is that you have like a net, and with that net you catch all the wrong views in the world. Yeah, all the wrong views are caught in this net. It's Brahma's net. And what you are left with is the teaching of the Buddha. It's the right view. So this sutta is all about wrong views. Yeah, so it lists 62 kinds of wrong views in this particular sutta. And it's interesting, it is the very first sutta of the long discourses. The long discourses is the very first collection, yeah, of the suttas. So it's basically the very first sutta there is. And it's fascinating that that sutta is about wrong views, and by implication about right view. Because it is kind of symbolized that right view is at the beginning of the spiritual path. That's what it kind of symbolizes, yeah, at the very beginning. Like Noble Eightfold Path, what is the first factor? Right view. Five spiritual faculties, you have, first one is like confidence and faith, is similar to right view. Yeah, this is always the foundation of the spiritual practice, right view. The Buddha teaching us what, how to think about the world. So it's fascinating here. And this is one of the suttas that is actually quoted elsewhere in the Nikayas. There is a quote in a sutta in the, I think it's Citta Sanyutta Nikaya, Citta Sanyutta. And there is Citta, he asks the Buddha, or he asks the monk, what is it that is the foundation for all these wrong views, all the 62 wrong views? Why do these 62 wrong views occur? Yeah, what is it that makes them appear? And it specifically says in there that the things that make the 62 wrong views appear is Sakkaya Ditti, personality view, yeah, the fact of personal, the view, the view of personal existence. It's not a fact at all, that's kind of the point. But the view of personal existence, in other words, the view that you have some permanent entity as part of you, that we are inherently permanent in some fundamental way, yeah. That is the foundation for these 62 views. Yeah, so these 62 views are all wrong in the sense that they assume a permanent self. And this is a standard way that wrong view is talked about in the suttas, yeah, that they assume a permanent self in one way or another. So these are 62 varieties of that assumption, how it comes out. And some of them are quite interesting, and we'll see that later on as we move through this. And they relate to some of the ancient misconceptions they had in India at that time, yeah, 2,500 years ago. And these are misconceptions that are still prevalent in the present day. So these are very kind of fundamental distortions of perception in, you know, among humanity, if you like. So this is the background for this sutta. And then the sutta starts out with the Buddha walking with the monks, walking from Rajagaha to Nalanda, and there's a couple of wanderers or ascetics walking behind them, and they're kind of criticizing and praising the Buddha, yeah? And then they have some little discussion about that, and the Buddha says, well, if you are criticized or praised, you should only ask yourself, is it true? And if it is true, then you can either rejoice if it's good, or, yeah, say, oh, yeah, it's good, we are, you know, doing all right, or if it's wrong, if it is bad what they're saying and it's still true, well then you have, you know, you have some kind of good feedback or something to that effect, is what they're saying. Yeah. And then the Buddha goes through a long section of sila, of conduct, of morality basically, and then he says that when ordinary people praise the Buddha, the reason why they praise the Buddha is for these superficial or minor things of morality. Yeah. So morality, of course, matters, is very important on the Buddhist path, but you don't actually praise the Buddha for morality, because morality is something that anyone can have. What you praise the Buddha for is an insight into the nature of reality, and that is directly related to the idea of right view. So first of all, the Buddha says, well, all of these things, people praise me for this, yeah, the morality, but that's kind of irrelevant. Now we get to the real thing, and this is what we're getting to today, the views. This is what the Buddha is kind of specialized in, looking at the world, seeing the world in the right way, understanding the nature of reality here. Yes, we're talking. Yes, that is a good question. I don't think anyone really knows exactly who curated the order. There is in the Dirgagama, the Sarvastivadin school version, which exists in Chinese translation. This sutta is number 21, so it's not number 1. Yeah. So it may have been after the various schools of Buddhism separated their ways, went different ways. It may have been curated or put together after that happened. We shouldn't read too much into the fact that the sutta is first. Yeah, obviously, the Buddha didn't put it there. We shouldn't read too much into it. But I suspect that those people who are from the, if you like, the Theravadan tradition, or the broader Theravadan, the Vibhajavadan tradition, whatever it is, they had a system. Yeah, they had a way of thinking about this. Can you hear me? Yeah? Okay. They had a way of thinking about this. That's why they did that. But not all schools of Buddhism thought about this in the same way. So they would have put things in a different sequence, maybe. Yeah, we don't know of many of the other schools. I mean, there's only two other schools that we know about. One is the Sarvastivadin, and then there's the Dharmaguptaka. Sarvastivadin found in Sanskrit translation, Dharmaguptaka in Chinese translation. I can't even remember what it is in the Sanskrit version, but I know in the version in Chinese it is 21, which is kind of similar, yeah. Because remember, usually these sutras they're divided up into chapters of 10 sutras. So 21 is the first sutta in its own chapter, yeah. So it could just be a movement around of the chapters, something like that. So it may be more to this than it actually meets the eye, perhaps. So, but yeah, so the curation is kind of a bit random. I like that way. Yeah, but you know, there is obviously some symbolism to it. That's why I'm kind of saying it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Supposedly, yeah. Yeah, he was supposed to be one of the lay people, one of the most amazing lay people at the time of the Buddha, supposed to have been a non-returner. Yeah. So, yeah, so he was pretty awesome, Chitta the householder, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so that is just a little bit of background. Is everyone happy with that background? Yeah, you sure? Okay, good. And then we move on. So now the Buddha starts talking about those things that actually is worth praising the Buddha for. So it says here, this is in Bhantasujato's translation, which we have chosen here. It has the great advantage, there's no copyright issues or anything like that, which is good. And so it says, these are now the theories about the past. Yeah? You notice the word theories there. So these are not considered factual from a Buddhist point of view. So there are other principles, dhammas is the Pali word here, deep, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful, sublime, beyond the scope of reason, subtle, comprehensible to the astute, it's like the wise, yeah, the pandita is the Pali word, and it's a word that you find in India today, pandita, you probably find it in Bengali, yeah. Yeah, pandit, exactly, yeah. A scholar, exactly, yeah. Which the realized one, the Tathagata, the Buddha, makes known after realizing them with his own insight. Those who genuinely praise the Buddha, the realized one, would rightly speak of these things. So what are these principles? So principles here could be also maybe be translated as truths, yeah? As things that the Buddha has seen for himself. So from a Buddhist point of view, these are truths about reality. It's about the nature of reality itself. And of course, all of these words that come after are important because the point is that they are hard to see deep. In other words, they are very rare in the world to see these things. And unless you have the kind of mental training that the Buddha has, or any other Aryan, you won't be able to see these things. And so they're hard to see, but this also beautiful thing, yeah, they are peaceful and sublime. And this is kind of interesting here, because normally when we think about views and theories, we don't think about the view or theory as peaceful. It's just a view, right? You believe in God or not, doesn't make you peaceful or not. You just believe in God or you don't believe in God. But these views, if you really see them, they have an effect on you psychologically. And this is one of the ways of knowing that something is really profound and really is meaningful, is the fact that it actually affects you psychologically. So if you have a real insight into the nature of existence, it should do something to your mind. Yeah, it should change you. And if it doesn't change you, if it doesn't make you into a different kind of person after having the insight, it is not really deep, not really profound. It's a beautiful thing, yeah? It's so different from normally how we think about views and ideas and all these things, yeah? I believe in this, I believe in that, but actually, it's not really deep. It doesn't make any difference to us psychologically. But these things, we know that they're right if they have a really profound impact on you, and you are changed as a person after coming out of these, after seeing these things. If you really see these things, things like morality is embedded in you. Yeah, they say the stream mentor is perfect in conduct. So you are, morality is embedded in you. The Noble Eightfold Path is embedded in you. These views can no longer change because you have seen truth once and for all. And for that reason, from then on, you are, basically, you become a different person. More kind, more, you know, all of these positive things are coming out of this. So that is kind of interesting, yeah? So these theories are peaceful and sublime beyond the scope of reason. Ataka vachara, ataka literally means like thinking. Yeah, beyond thinking, you cannot think yourself to these truths. You have to see them directly when the mind is very profound and still. You see these things through stillness, not through the rumination of the mind. It's the opposite of thinking. It's when you become peaceful that you see these things. Ataka vachara. Subtle, yeah, comprehensible to the astute, yeah, okay, the wise, the astute. I think the reason why he uses the word astute instead of wise is because the word wise is so useful. So there are so many words translated as wise. So I think he's kind of fumbling around to find alternative translations. So he has come up with the word astute. You like the word astute? Is it good? Yeah? Astute, yeah? I guess it does the job, yeah. And then he makes them known, yeah, so he teaches the Dhamma, that's why we have the sutta, he makes them known after realizing them with his own insight. This is why we should praise the Buddha. This is profound, this is important stuff. So what are these things that he has realized? And now we get to all of these views, yeah, that are wrong, and then the Buddha will explain all these wrong views, and it will explain why they are wrong, and so this is quite exciting, yeah. And now we can kind of criticize all the philosophies and all the religions in the world. Are you looking forward to that? Maybe we should turn off the live stream before we do that. It kind of get a bit scary if we criticize everything. Anyway, it's important, yeah. It's not so much that you criticize others, but you have to kind of make a distinction between these things. If we don't make a distinction, then it's kind of pointless. We have to make distinctions in this world. And this idea of making distinctions and distinguishments is actually fundamental to any kind of search for truth. Some things just aren't true. Yeah, and other things are. And we have to make that difference. So this is important. Sometimes we hear things like, oh yeah, they all pass up the same mountain, they all go to the top and they reach the same place. But that is not what the Buddha is teaching. Yeah, he doesn't teach that they're all paths up to the top. They may go partly up the mountain, but to actually reach the very top takes something very special. And we would kind of expect that, yeah, if everyone was practicing the right path, and everyone in the world would be blissed out and happy here. Yeah? That's not the case, yeah. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here if we already were blissed out and happy already and peaceful. Yeah? So obviously that is not the case. So it is an important point, but we shouldn't, it's not about putting down other teachings, it's more about understanding the difference. So then the Buddha says there are some ascetics and Brahmins who theorize about the past and assert various hypotheses concerning the past on 18 grounds. What are these 18 grounds on which they rely? So we're going to look at things concerning the past. It is not very kind of clearly distinguished, but past can also be about the future, as we shall see, but they are called theories about the past. And the words here that are used about theories and hypotheses, there are words like kapika and anuditti, which have this idea of theorizing, of thinking them out. Yeah? These they are based on not direct insight. Yeah, this is kind of the point here. Yeah? So this is what this is kind of the distinction here, yeah, between theorizing about the past on the one hand and then direct realization on the other hand. Yeah? So what are these 18 grounds on which they rely? Yeah. So first of all, we come to eternalism. And you notice the Pali word for eternalism is sasatavada. You haven't got the Pali there, have you, Nicholas? No, it doesn't matter. Don't just leave it out. It gets too complicated, perhaps, if you get too much text and things. But I'll just tell you the words in Pali. Sasatavada is a Pali word. Vada in Pali, literally vada, means to speak. Yeah, it's from the verb vadati, to speak. So vada has the idea of doctrine or teaching. Yeah, so it's a doctrine of sasata, and sasata means eternalism in Pali. Yeah? So this is what this is about, the doctrine of eternalism. So, so let's see what he has to say about this. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who are eternalists, who assert the self and the cosmos are eternal on four grounds. What are the four grounds on which they rely? Okay, so ascetics and Brahmins, these were the two classes, if you like, of spiritual seekers in ancient India. The Brahmins were the hegemonic kind of the mainstream spiritual seekers. Sometimes they were just priests, and then the ascetics were like the people came out a bit more from left field, yeah, they kind of left society and they searched outside of the mainstream. And they included the Buddha and they included a large number of other sects in ancient India who were searching for truth, in a sense. And India is a very kind of interesting society in this way. All these various people searching for truth, having all these kind of crazy ideas, yeah. And we sort of think sometimes that in our modern culture we are very open to all kind of ideas, but in ancient India probably much more open than we are today, yeah. And all kind of, and then they would debate and they would come together, yeah. And they would kind of, people would listen to these debates. Maybe we should have some of these debates here. I think so. Should we invite some people from other religions and have debates in here, and then we can argue it out, and we can say, "No, you are wrong. I am right." Well, that's nonsense that you're saying. That's kind of how they would talk to each other at that time. It's really kind of fascinating here. So these are the religious seekers at that time. That's why it says Brahmins and ascetics in this way here. Yes, sir. There are the Jains, there are the Ajivikas. You have the six main groups of ascetics as talked about in the suttas. Yeah, they were led by the various people. Ajita Kesakambali, Makkali Gosala, Nigantanathaputta as leader of the Jains. Then you have the Buddha. Then you have Sanjaya, who was a skeptic, yeah, who didn't have taken a position. He was an eel wriggler. Then you had, who is the last one of these six ones? Oh, that's actually probably two more, actually. Anyway, there's six of them. I can't remember all the names of them at the moment. Jains were one of the biggest ones, most important ones, and they probably existed prior to the Buddha, and they would have been very significant, you're right. And they existed, even exist to the present day, yeah? So they are obviously very, you know, it's kind of, this is one of the things that make these suttas so historical. You see things in the suttas that still exist in the present day. You see the continuity in these things. It makes them really come alive, yeah, in a very powerful way. I find that so fascinating. This is one of the very interesting things about going to India, on pilgrimage to India, and see the sites, and you see the places, and you recognize them in the suttas. I said this many times before, but for me that is a real eye-opener, because the suttas may seem theoretical and far away, and you wonder, are these just fantasies or whatever? Until you go to India and you recognize the places, you can actually almost follow things, yeah, the path of the suttas in real, you know, see the kind of geographical features and all that kind of thing in India. So they assert the self and the cosmos are eternal on four grounds. So what is this self and cosmos business? What is that all about? Point here is that a very large part of the ancient Brahmanical teaching, yeah, especially later on after the time of the Buddha, you have the Advaita Vedanta that you may have heard of. Have you heard about Advaita Vedanta? It's one of the main streams of contemplative, call it Hinduism if you like, came out of the Brahmanical circles. Advaita means non-dual, and Vedanta means the end of the Vedas. It's like the end period of the Vedic scriptures, yeah, the Upanishads and the ancient Vedas, the Rig Veda, the Sama Veda, Yajur Veda. These were the ancient holy scriptures of ancient Brahmanism that they still have in the present day. Yeah. And one of the main contemplative schools that came out of this is known as Advaita Vedanta. And this school holds this kind of view, yeah? The self and the cosmos are eternal. And they don't really distinguish between the self and the cosmos. The cosmos is like Brahma, yeah? So the idea is that the change of things, the changing, it seems like everything is changing all the time, yeah? But they would argue that's only like appearances. It only appears to change. Behind the facade of change, there is something eternal, and the eternal is the self, yeah? It resides inside of us, yeah? And this is, of course, the same kind of self that the vast majority of religions talk about, yeah? The idea of a soul or a self, something inherent. And in the same way as there is something inherent inside each one of us that is always there and everything else is just appearances, in the same way, the cosmos is exactly the same. There's something behind all the apparent changes in the cosmos, the galaxies, the planets, or whatever moving around, and that is Brahma, yeah, the God, the supreme of everything. Yeah. And more than that, the self inside each one of us and the Brahma are in fact one. Yeah, this is the argument. So when you die, you kind of just bang, you kind of go back to Brahma again, you go back to your original state. It's just that we are in a state of delusion. We don't see things according to reality. We see things according to superficial appearances, and we don't really see things as they actually are. So this is this kind of view, yeah, that you find today in Advaita Vedanta. Advaita Vedanta is still very much taught in the world today. You will find lots of people, and in fact, I know people here in Perth who are followers of Advaita Vedanta. Yeah, there's one lecturer at UWA, a woman who is very much into this thing, and she's a very kind of top scholar in this area, and I know her quite well. She comes to the monastery sometimes. She's also kind of a Buddhist hybrid Advaita Vedanta person. And they're kind of fascinating, yeah. And this is kind of where it gets interesting, yeah. Is there a problem there? Can you be both Buddhist and Advaita Vedanta, or do you have to separate? This is where it gets really exciting, yeah. So I don't know if she's watching this talk. Maybe she might get a bit upset with me if she listens to this talk. But so this is where it gets really, it's really interesting. This ancient idea that exists in the present day, and yeah, they still have some sages in the Advaita Vedanta tradition, a famous one called Ramana Maharshi from India, I don't know if anyone here has heard of him, but he died back in the 1960s or something, and he was very, obviously had something going for him, some very powerful samadhi or something, because that is what they do. They do samadhi practices, which of course is basically what we do as well. So there's a lot of similarities there. So this is the idea here, that this is the thing that he is criticizing. So it can be argued, and I think it looks to me like what he is arguing against is precisely those kind of views, Advaita Vedanta views, this non-dual tradition, yeah, of Hinduism. So, anyway, so people are making these arguments, and they're making them on four grounds. Is that what they say? Yeah, four grounds. So what are these four grounds? So now let's see how these arguments arise according to Buddhism. It's when some ascetic or Brahmin, by dint of keen, resolute, committed, and diligent effort, and right focus, experiences an immersion of the heart, of such a kind that they recollect the many kinds of past lives. Yeah, so you are committed and you practice and all these things and you gain immersion of the heart. Now this is one of Ajahn Siddhartha's kind of ways of translating. So for those of you who know the way he translates, immersion here is for samadhi. Yeah, that's how we translate samadhi. So immersion of the heart is literally cheto samadhi in Pali, and cheto can be rendered as heart or mind. Yeah, but basically it means just samadhi. That's what it means. In other words, jhanas and the deep meditation states is what we're talking about here. Please feel free to stop me at any time. Sometimes I assume more knowledge, yeah, I don't even think about it myself, than people may have. So please ask really simple questions. What do you mean, samadhi? What does that mean? I never heard it before. It is okay to be ignorant, yeah? You don't have to know everything beforehand. So please feel free to ask questions at any time. No question is not too stupid, but some questions are too smart alecky, yeah? So, but no one is too stupid. So please feel free to ask anything, basically. I'm open for anything, yeah? So, based on that samadhi, you can recollect your past lives, yeah? And this is something we do in Buddhism as well, yeah? So what is it that we recollect? That is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100,000, 100,000 rebirths. 100,000 rebirths, yeah, that's pretty cool to remember that. And then it says here, many eons of cosmos contracting, and that is a mistake, it shouldn't be there. So forget about the many eons of cosmos contracting, forget about the many eons of cosmos expanding, forget about the many eons of cosmos contracting and expanding. That shouldn't be there, it's a mistake in the translation. And I already told Bhante Sujato, so hopefully he will remove that. So anyway, so but you remember up to 100,000 rebirths, yeah? And what they remember is this. There I was named this. My clan was that. I looked like this. That was my food. This was how I felt pleasure and pain. That was how my life ended. Or that was the length of my lifespan, I think is more correct, actually, personally. When I passed away from that place, I was reborn somewhere else. There too, yeah, or you know... There I was named this, my clan was that, I looked like this, that was my food, this is how I felt pleasure and pain. That was the end, that was the length of my life. When I passed away from that place, I was reborn here. In other words, in this existence now, that's what that means. In this way, I recollected the many kinds of past lives with the feature and details. So you will notice here that the proper recollection of past lives is very detailed. You have a very clear understanding of what is going on. You know about, very specifically, your name, your family. You have a very clear understanding of who you are, almost like you would have a memory of yourself in this life. Yeah? If someone asked you to ask you to write a CV of yourself in this life, it would be easy. You know, you this kind of education, this kind of work experience, blah, 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 and you will be able to sort it out. In the same way, actually not in the same way, actually with much more clarity. This is what is interesting here. If you remember like this, because your mind is so incredibly powerful, it is like you are reliving it. Yeah, you are there reliving these things, which is far more powerful than an ordinary memory. So these are very, very powerful memories. And not only are they powerful, but they are structured. Yeah, you can see how you flow through time, go from one life to the next one, ending up in the present life. The majority of people who talk about past life experience, they have like a glimpse, yeah, they see, bang, an image of a past, and they say, that's my past life. But that is very uncertain and very unreliable. Maybe it is, maybe it is not. If you want to be sure that you have recalled your past life, you have to see the kind of causal sequence of things going over time like this. And it has to be based on a real state of deep samadhi. Then you know what you're talking about. And you can kind of relive these experiences. Yes? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 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 Not necessarily. It really depends. Yeah, I wouldn't say it is. It's not exclusively Buddhist. I wouldn't say it's very common either. It's not like it's like maybe one in a million or one in 10 million or something who do this kind of stuff. Yeah, so it would be very rare, but it can be done. Yeah, that's kind of the main point. Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, yeah, very impressive. Yeah, so, yeah, but we don't live in very spiritual times, you know. We don't live in times where, the 2,500 years ago, probably far more spiritual society than we have now, where people who are samanas were really supported and looked after. When India still had a lot of forest and people could go out and living in the forest. Much more difficult today to be an ascetic anywhere in the world than it was at that time. So it depends on all the supportive conditions, how good are they to support you. And that kind of society would have more ascetics, yeah, because they had the supporting conditions. So I think it's very hard to say, but regardless, it's rare. Yeah, yeah. But yes, it will happen outside of Buddhism. It will happen in any teaching where they practice samadhi seriously. Yeah. 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 That's the only thing of the future. View is make or break. And this is why, you know, the Buddha giving the teaching is so important. Yeah. It starts the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah. So this is what this ascetic does. Yeah. He practices in this way. And then what happens? They say, yeah, that those ascetics and Brahmins, they say, the self and the cosmos are eternal, barren, steady as a mountain peak, standing firm like a pillar. They remain the same for all eternity, while these sentient beings wander and transmigrate, and pass away and re-arise. Why is that? Because by dint of keen, resolute, committed and diligent effort, and right focus, I experience an immersion, a samadhi of the mind, of the heart, of such a kind that I recollect all of these past lives with their details and their features. Yeah, so based on that, yeah, you come to this conclusion. Yeah, and it's kind of interesting how it is phrased. They're quite poetic, these people. Yeah, the cosmos is eternal, barren. What does barren mean? That's a weird word, isn't it? To understand what these terms mean, you can get some idea by thinking about it yourself, but it's not so obvious. And if you really are interested in some of the philosophical implications of what is going on in the sutta, I would recommend you to read an essay by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, which is available online. You can just download it. Just search on the sutta and on Bhikkhu Bodhi and PDF, and you can download a book, 300 pages. And it's basically a translation of the sutta together with commentaries and introductory material. And he will explain things like barren. What is barren doing here? And the idea of the word barren is that the world is what it is. It doesn't lead. It doesn't have any effect beyond itself. Yeah, it doesn't kind of create anything new. And this is what I mentioned before, this idea of the distinction between Brahma, the eternal self or the eternal God, which is always there, and the appearance of things. Everything that is changing is only appearance. But Brahma, the eternal thing behind everything, is barren. Doesn't actually create anything new. It is the eternal presence and reality in the cosmos. So this is the idea of barren, yeah? And this is one of the reasons why you can This looks a bit like Advaita Vedanta, because this is very similar to the Advaita Vedanta ideas, that things aren't, there's nothing really existence apart from Brahma and the Self. Yeah, these two things that exist, and everything else is just appearances and things changing all the time. So this is the idea of Baron. Am I making sense? Yes, Nicholas? Yeah. It's the same kind of mind, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So you can remember things like when you were a child, or when you were, maybe even when you were in your mother's womb. Yeah, recall like that. You can, because the mind becomes so powerful. Huh? And some of those memories might be very strange, might be very weird, and you may have a hard time seeing it as yourself. Yeah, and because we change a lot. Imagine remembering yourself in a past life as a mosquito. Huh? Yeah, that would be kind of... Yeah, exactly. So that would definitely give a lot of confidence, precisely. That's exactly it. Yeah, so that is the thing here. Okay. But that's a bit of a sidetrack, because I want to focus on the views now. So let's just focus on the views, because otherwise I think I'm just concerned we get too far tracked down the thing. So. Yeah. Yeah. Well, but briefly, the idea of remembering your past lives is just that you see the enormity of suffering. Yeah. You see yourself moving through these things, doing the same mistake again and again, one life after the other, and you get this incredible aversion towards rebirth. You see, wow, this is just terrible. I'm just doing the same thing again and again, and you get this aversion. Well, what you want to do is that you want to make an end of it. Yeah, and so you become more committed to the Buddhist path. That's what happens usually. Yeah. Well, that's what comes out of it. Yeah. It actually makes you a better person. It's weird. Some may sound weird, but it actually makes you a better person when you see that. You can imagine, yeah, because you realize it's not just you, it's all beings that are going through this, yeah? So, yeah. 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 Excellent. Okay. Yeah. So, and there's other things here, like steady as a mountain peak, standing firm like a pillar, this idea of something that is just there, yeah, the self is always kind of available. Huh? And they remain like that for all eternity, yeah? And then you have, while these sentient beings wander and transmigrate, so again you have this difference between what is behind the surface, the real thing, and then the appearances, the surface, yeah, the wandering and the transmigrating, which is then the superficial things, and behind that you have this eternalist view. So you can see here that you're making a claim, you're taking up a view based on remembering your past lives. Yeah, but can you make that claim based on that view? And the answer is probably not. Yeah, you're probably going a bit too far. You have seen past lives going on for a long, long time, but you haven't actually seen, it doesn't say that here anyway, that you haven't actually seen anything solid. You haven't seen anything eternal. And this is one of the things that kind of happens with all these views and theories, that you go beyond the evidence. The evidence is your past lives. The evidence is certain things you experience. But you go beyond that evidence to make a claim about the reality. And that's why it becomes a view. It becomes a theory. It does not become something that actually reflects reality the way it is. And this is always the problem with these things, that you go beyond the evidence. And the reason why you go beyond the evidence, and this comes back to this other suit I was talking about before, is because we have certain predetermined ideas about the world inside of us. I exist, yeah? It feels like I exist. Okay, this I, that is what is always there where all these things change. Yeah, we're talking.
Yes, the problem is the
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So would they have come to the same conclusion of karma and karma with Papa?
They might, but I would say that's an even deeper insight. Yeah? So that's an additional insight on top of the rebirth insight. So they could, maybe if they looked at that very carefully and they analyzed it properly. Yeah? But actually, it's quite a profound insight, because even the Buddha would say, you know, sometimes you cannot see how karma vipaka is not something like, for example, goes from one life to the next one. Sometimes there might be many lives in between karma and its fruit. So it's actually quite a hard thing to see, and it takes very subtle mind to be able to understand that properly. Yeah. So I would say probably not. Yeah. And the more of these things you realize, the more the point comes that you start to understand, actually, there is no self behind this. Yeah. This is an impersonal process. That is what karma vipaka in part is about. This is an impersonal process. The more of that you see, the closer you are to seeing reality. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Probably not. Maybe partially, because in Hinduism they have the idea of karma vipaka as well. But probably not fully understood, because fully understood really requires seeing non-self properly. Yeah. But the vast majority of religions in the world, they have an idea of a God. They have an idea of an eternal substance. Why? Because it reflects how we see ourselves. So we take that inner feeling and we project it onto the universe. And this is how the vast majority of religions, you know, talk about creator gods or Brahma, the everlasting, or whatever it is. And so this is how naturally, you would tend to interpret this kind of experience. Yeah? You interpret in terms of that idea that is already there. Yeah? This is a very... Yeah, okay, Nicholas, go for it. Yeah. There is no beginning. Yeah, yeah. The question does arise, and the Buddha says you cannot find the beginning. It's unfindable. Why? You can just go back and back and back. There's always another cause before the previous effect. Yeah. And this is one of the things which makes Buddhism different from almost any other religion, because almost all religion, a very important part of their purpose is to explain the beginning of things. Yeah, God created the universe. Even science has this idea, okay, Big Bang is the beginning. Yeah. But Buddhism is the only religion in the world that says everything goes in cycles, and you cannot find the beginning here. There's another cycle before the previous one here. Dependent origination? Yeah. Yes, but this thing is this thing doesn't have a first beginning here. It begins with ignorance, dependent origination. It begins with avidya, ignorance or delusion. Yeah, and delusion has no first point. So you go back and you find delusion before delusion. Delusion begets more delusion. Delusion is self-perpetuating, carrying on into the future. There is no first point of delusion, just as if there is no first point of rebirth. Yeah, it's the same thing. So it's the same. So delusion and samsara and the world, all of these things are just different ways of looking at the same thing, really. It's really hard to grasp that, but the idea of rebirth is the same thing as the idea of delusion in a sense. Yeah? Things are going on and on and on before. Well, once you say the word eternal, you are on kind of thin, but there is no first cause. It's much better way of thinking about it. Yeah. The Buddha does not actually say it goes back to infinity. He doesn't say that. Because that is not something you can observe. This is the thing about the Buddha. He just says what you can actually observe. And what you can observe is that you cannot find the first cause. You go back and back and back. So that's all he says. He says there is no first cause. But he doesn't go beyond the evidence and make the claim that it is eternal. Which is kind of fascinating. Yeah, it's all very pragmatic.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what the Buddha doesn't make that claim. He doesn't make the claim that there is a first beginning, but he does make the claim that there is no essence in the universe. There is no creative power. No, there is nobody who has actually made this whole thing here. Because that requires some kind of thing to be there which actually creates stuff, like a god or whatever. And that fact that there is nothing essential to the universe, that is something you can discover through meditation. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, so this is this idea, yeah, and this is one of the reasons why in Buddhism we have to be careful with logic even. And this is one of the things that you find in the Kalama Sutta, yeah. I think I did the Kalama Sutta here before. It's a very beautiful sutta, one of the basic kind of ways of thinking about spirituality, and where the Buddha says you should not rely on tradition, religious traditions, you should not rely on logic. Instead, he says, this is to people who are beginning on the path, you should rely on your own experience. Yeah. It's very fascinating, because you need to kind of break out of the things that trap you in the universe. And the only way to break out is to rely on your experience. It's a bit like whatever you can know through experience, that is, it's a bit almost like some of the philosophers who are pragmatists, yeah, and you can only be whatever is actually available to the senses, and you can know directly, that is what you take as truth. Anything beyond that is kind of speculation. And the reason is because the reason why logic is problematic, you can start to see now. You can start to see this here. The reason why logic is problematic is because logic is based on certain assumptions. Yeah, and in Buddhism, there's one assumption that is always there that we take with us, always. And that is the assumption that there is some eternal essence inside of us. The sense of self is always there. So for that reason, the moment we start to use logic, that assumption, we take it with us. And this is the problem. And you can see this problem happening here. And this is what the Buddha says in the Kalama Sutta. Okay, drop that logic for a while. Yeah, experience things first. See things deeply. Once you have seen things deeply, then you can apply logic. You can apply inference and all of these things in the right way. Because now you have the information. You know what to do. So all of this is quite fascinating here. So, okay, so because of all this, you recall all these past lives. Still, you don't get it right, yeah, because you take some wrong assumptions with you, yeah. And so because of all of these things, that's why I know, it says there, the self and the cosmos are eternal, barren, steady as a mountain peak, standing firm like a pillar. They remain the same for all eternity, while these sentient beings wander and transmigrate and pass away and re-arise. This is the first ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely on to assert that the self and the cosmos are eternal. So we have done the first ground. There's only 62 views. That's the first one. Took about an hour. So we have no. Yes, please. It's tragic. Yeah. Probably, yes. Quite likely. Yeah. If you have a view and you look at the world in a certain way, then it's usually you cling to those views. Yeah. Superpower. Lot of power there. Yeah. It's exactly right. It's like the Buddha said. Well, he, after he passed away and, after his awakening, and he was thinking, who should I teach now? And I should teach Alara Kalama and Uddhakaramaputta, because they are ready. They have all the faculties, they're ready. And these people would also be ready. If they would listen to the Buddha, they would get the truth very, very fast. So, any more comments on this then? The first ground. It depends. It really depends on how attached they are to these views. I mean, I think it will vary enormously. You're right. It doesn't necessarily, just because they are closer in one way, in another way they might be further away because they have strong views about things. So it really depends. Yeah, it's hard to say. Yeah. That could block them, huh? Unless you have maybe if you are very wise, you might be able to kind of, you know, show them the flaw in the argument. They might say, wow, there's a flaw there. Okay, I will listen to you. Maybe. Yeah. Yeah, that's cataclysmic. Everything comes crashing down. Yeah. Yeah. So we have to go beyond being mere mortals and kind of get into it. Yeah. Okay, let's go on to the second ground. What is the second ground on which they rely? And we will see that these are very, very similar to the previous ones. We can go through this quite faster. It's when some ascetic or Brahmin, by dint of keen, resolute, committed, and diligent effort, and right focus, experiences a samadhi of such a kind that they recollect the many kinds of past lives. That is, now we get the eons, one eon of cosmic contraction, an expansion, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 eons of cosmic contraction and expansion. It's kind of fascinating. These words in Pali that is translated here as cosmic contraction is sangvatta and vivatta. And you may wonder, how do we know that they mean cosmic expansion? What the words themselves actually mean something like, the word vatta means to revolve, yeah, to roll around. And sang is kind of revolved together, another one is revolved apart. So it's very similar to the idea of evolution, yeah, things evolving. It's almost exactly the same word, but in the Pali language rather than in English. And then you have involution or devolution, where they come together again. So the ideas are very, very similar to what we have in English here. And very often they are applied to, literally to the cosmos, yeah, to kind of, planets and suns appearing, etc. So it looks like, on the surface, I must admit, it really does look like they are talking about similar to things that we are talking about now, like the Big Bang and these kind of things, yeah? That's what it looks like. So I think the translation, evolution, cosmic expansion and contraction probably is justified in this context. You could be a little bit more conservative and say that it just talks about the evolution of the universe without specifying the Big Bang or anything like that. But I think it is fair to assume that the Buddha actually saw this. I'm quite happy with translating it in that way. Anyway, so yeah, it's so very much the same as the previous one, except that you see even more, yeah, you see the whole universe going in these cycles. And I have mentioned it before that I think, you know, down the track, cosmology, as they keep on investigating the cosmos, and there are some people already doing that kind of research, that they will come down to the idea that the cosmos is expanding and contracting, is going through cycles. Exactly how, I don't know, but some kind of cycle going through round and around and again. And there are some cosmologists who actually are pursuing those ideas with good results. And I would say that eventually, basing myself on the confidence in the suttas, that this will be, I think, ultimately the prevailing view also in modern cosmology. We shall see what happens down the track. Anyway, it's a bit of a sidetrack. So then, yeah, having seen this, you remember, yeah, there I was named this, my clan was that, I looked like this, and that was my food, that was how I felt pleasure and pain, that was how long my life was, and when I passed away from that place, I was reborn somewhere else, there too I was named like this, my clan was like that, I looked like this, that was my food, I felt like this, my life was that long, and I passed away from there, and I was reborn here, yeah, bang, here I am, poof, oh, okay. Wow, that was a bit of a journey to get here. Imagine you think that you have traveled a long way in this life, but jeepers, this journey is really becomes extraordinary when you see all of this. And to recall all their many past lives with the features and details over all of these eons. And then based on that you say, the self and the cosmos are eternal, barren, steady as a mountain peak, standing firm like a pillar. They remain the same for all eternity, while the sentient beings wander and transmigrate and pass away and re-arise. Why is that? Well, because of all of this, I have seen all of this stuff, yeah? So that's why I know that the self and the cosmos are eternal, barren, etc. And all of these beings pass away. This is the second ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely to assert the self and the cosmos are eternal. So, just repeating for effect, yeah, it's the same thing, except that you see even more. Some people need more evidence to come to the same conclusions. And obviously it is quite different to see the cosmos going in cycles. That's quite different from just seeing your own rebirth or your own life going in cycles. So there's a lot of more information there going on. Yes, Nicholas. I think what it is, I would guess it is, if you're a human being, you wouldn't be able to see this. It's just too hard because you are just in the middle of this. So I would say it has to do with the fact that you get reborn in some very high realm where you are beyond all of this and you actually see this happening here. We'll see this later on in this particular sutta. It talks about when the universe collapses, then being tends to move to these high realms because everything else gets destroyed. Yeah, so it's almost as if you get that bird's eye view, yeah, and you see kind of a thing from afar and you see how things happening. But it's a good point because you wonder how can you actually see this? Yeah, so yeah. It is absolutely definitely more powerful, yeah, because your memory is better, yeah. More tragic, yeah, you see more dukkha, yeah, it's even worse than you thought. Well, I don't think it's much, well, is it further? Yeah, I don't know, it really depends on the, yeah. I think it just varies enormously on the person, yeah, and it depends on what kind of background they have and all these kind of things. Some people are going to be open to be persuaded, others are not, depending on how strong faith they have in their own religion, all these kind of things. But I think the more information you have, obviously the more understanding you have of reality already. So in one way, it's going to be helpful. Yeah, it just depends on whether you're open or not to that extra information that the Buddha provides. That's the question here. Yeah. Yeah, and some of them were not open to anything, yeah. But some were, yeah? Yeah, so, yeah. So, what is the third ground? And again, very similar. It's when some ascetics and Brahmins, by dint of keen, resolute, committed, and diligent effort and right focus, experiences a samadhi, an immersion of the heart. Samadhi, yeah, stillness of the mind, as a Brahmin might say, of such a kind that they recollect the many kinds of past lives. That is 10 eons of cosmic contraction. 20, 30, 40 eons of cosmic contracting and expanding. They remember, there I was named this, my clan was that, I looked like this, my footless was my food, I felt pleasure and pain like this. My life was so long. When I passed away from there, I was reborn somewhere else. There too, I was named like this, my clan was like that, I looked like this, this was my food. And I felt pleasure and pain in this way, and that was the length of my life. When I passed away from that place, I was reborn here. And so they recollect the many kinds of past lives with the features and their details. Wow. So not only 100,000 birds, yeah, but I don't know how they can do this. It sounds like maybe they just kind of skip through certain birds really, really fast and they recall other ones in more detail. Otherwise, it would take you an eon just to recall all of these things. No wonder they can remember so many eons. That's the case. And then they come to the conclusion, yeah? The self and the cosmos are eternal, barren, steady as a mountain peak, standing firm like a pillar. They remain the same for all eternity, while these sentient beings wander and transmigrate, and pass away and re-arise. Why is that? And then he says, everything again one more time. Because of dint of all this hard practice, I recalled all of these past lives with the features, the details, and because of that, I believe the cosmos and the self are eternal, barren, steady as a mountain peak, standing firm like a pillar, to remain like that for eternity, and etc., etc. This is the third ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely to assert that the self and the cosmos are eternal. Yeah. Yeah. And this is one of the things that the Buddha is supposed to have done. Yeah, on his night when he. So your question is, I'll repeat it for the audience online. Is this what the Buddha himself might have done? And yes, exactly right. This is kind of what he says later on. He did on his night of awakening. Yeah, he went through the samadhi stages. Then he recalled his past lives. Whether he recalled so many straight away or whether he did that later on is hard to know, but he did something to this effect. And this is, I think, because the Buddha was open-minded, he wasn't attached to any particular view before that. When he saw this, what he saw was suffering. He saw dukkha, yeah, big picture dukkha. And I think this is one of the things that enabled him to break through, yeah, because you need a very powerful understanding of dukkha to be able to see through non-self. Because the self is so dear to you, you have to really understand that the self actually is not really worthwhile holding on to. And to be able to see that, you have to see suffering in a very profound way. Only then are you able to let go of something which is so close to you as the perception of a self.
He was certainly guided by the past Buddha.
He was guided by a past Buddha. That is Ajahn Brahm's contention that he remembered his life under the past Buddha. And there is some evidence for that in the sutta, some of the Gatikara Sutta, where he was a disciple under Buddha Kassapa in a previous life. And it's very hard to know. Yeah, that's what Ajahn Brahm reckons. But I think it is, even for Ajahn Brahm, it is mostly a nice theory. Yeah, I don't think you can really have any knowledge of that, because it depends on, we don't know how far he went on the path at that point, whether he became an Arya or not, or he would have had the teachings, or whether he remembered that in his present life. All of these things are uncertain. At what point did he remember living under that Buddha? Maybe that's the case. Who knows? Yeah, it is a little bit difficult to know. But he wouldn't have really happened. So I guess the point here is that would have happened when he recalled his past lives. And then he might have remembered those teachings, yeah? If he was lucky, if he focused
he
material.
Must, right? If you could get it so in such great details, not just
yeah.
A DVD.
Yeah. So it's possible that he would have remembered that in his
that
past life. Yeah.
Remember this dialogue like that, right?
Yeah. So there's two possibilities. He remembered the teaching of the past Buddha, which was a great help. Or he just saw the great dukkha of samsara, which enabled him to kind of reject the self.
But with that, it would be very, very dangerous at that point, right? He could have hardened his self-view or make the breakthrough, right?
Yeah, but because it didn't really come with much baggage, because he had rejected a lot of the existing views already, he didn't have much baggage, he was more open to the possibilities. Anyway. Anything else on this one? Yeah. How close would such a person be to being a stream winner? Is your question?
That experience such things.
Very, very close. Yeah. All you need to do is just to someone kind of switching your way of thinking and turning you in a different direction, and bang, you would be a stream winner here. Because your samadhi will be very, very powerful, and that samadhi which kind of enables you to break through. On top of that, you will have a lot of understanding of the nature of rebirth. On top of that, yes, you have a lot of information, and so a little bit of change of view, and you would be a stream. Maybe even you become arahant straight away because you have so much information. Is everyone okay? Is anyone who is lost and haven't got a clue what I'm talking about, who feel, whoa, what is this? I'm never going to come back here again. This is crazy. Everyone okay? Yeah. You come back in the next life. Now that is wrong view, you know. That is not, please don't do that. Next life, don't come. Okay. So let's move on to the fourth ground. Let's see. Okay, should be okay. The fourth ground on which they rely. It's when some ascetics and Brahmin relies on logic and inquiry. They speak of what they have worked out by logic, following a line of inquiry, expressing their own perspective. The self and the cosmos are eternal, barren, steady as a mountain peak, standing firm like a pillar. They remain the same for all eternity, while these sentient beings wander and transmigrate and pass away and re-arise. This I have hammered out by reasoning. Yeah, this must be the absolute truth, because my reasoning is impeccable and flawless. This is the fourth ground on which those ascetics and Brahmins assert that the self and the cosmos are eternal. Any ascetics and Brahmins who assert that the self and the cosmos are eternal do so on one or other of these four grounds. Outside of this, there is none, he says. So you hammer it out by reasoning, yeah? You kind of use your logic, yeah? But again, because your logic is flawed, this is what I was saying before about logic being flawed, because it is based on the wrong assumptions, and logic based on the wrong assumptions is going to be problematic. Yeah, you can. This is always like that. Any logic based on the wrong assumption obviously is going to be problematic. Yeah, like mathematics is always based on certain axioms and assumptions, and if they are based on dodgy axioms, in fact, you can have different kinds of mathematics depending on what axioms you have. Yeah, they talk about different kinds of mathematics. It's kind of weird. In the same way here, you can probably have all kind of different views depending on what kind of axioms and assumptions you have. But are they going to be true? Well, not if those axioms are dodgy axioms, dodgy assumptions. So please don't have dodgy assumptions.
Why is this considered the last of the four grounds when this is the lowliest of all? Of all the four, I mean? Where these are just mere scientists and mathematicians. My mind says about this.
Yeah. Why is it last? Yeah. I don't think you need to read too much into the sequence. I don't know if the sequence really says that much. I'm not sure why the sequence, the first three, the sequence is obvious, yeah, one longer than the next one. Why this one is fourth, either it would be the last one or it might be the first one, yeah, so that's really the question, I suppose. Don't know, maybe it has something to do with memory. These were all memorized texts. Maybe this is easier to memorize in this sequence, maybe. Maybe that's the reason. I don't think we should read too much. In this case, I don't know if you can read too much meaning into the sequence.
Right now, the prevailing view is that matter is over mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, mind arises out of matter.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is the mainstream view.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that arises from logic and reasoning.
Whereas the other view might very well be a more like mental view. It could be the opposite. It could be more like a idealist kind of view.
Sometimes the last is first and the first is last. If you have a look at the nature of a lot of things in this universe, so some things is like that. I think the ego is like that as well.
Yeah. I think one of the things about the Buddha's teaching is that usually it is very, very systematic. Yeah, and usually sequences have a purpose. Usually, like the Noble Eightfold Path is a particular sequence, and it's very clear because the Buddha even shows you that this goes step by step, or the seven factors of awakening, they have a certain sequence, yeah? And so usually these things have a purpose to them, the sequence, but not always. There are cases, as you say, that it's not like that, and I think this might be one of those cases. Or it could just be the limits of our understanding. We don't really know why it is like that. But yeah. Okay. Shall we do one more? Are you up for that? Or are you exhausted already? Who wants to do one more? One, two, three, four. Okay. Who does not want to do one more? Lynn. Okay. You're outvoted, Lynn. You have no choice. Who wants to do one less? Because they're already too much. That would be. Okay. I think we're going to do. Yeah. Well, are you happy to go with the majority, Lynn? Yeah? Okay, so there you are. Now it's unanimous. Okay, marvelous. Well done. Okay. That's how. Yeah. Okay, good. So let's do one more, because the next one is actually quite interesting here. Yeah, actually, maybe not. Sorry. Maybe we don't have to do... maybe there is a... Let's see if there is a recap here. So these are the four grounds on which those ascetics and Brahmins assert that the self and the cosmos are eternal. Any ascetics and Brahmins who assert that the self and the cosmos are eternal do so on one or other of these four grounds. Outside of this, there is none. Actually, there is a... Now comes the Buddha's understanding of this. So maybe this will suffice for... Let's see what happens here. So the realized one, the Buddha, understands this. If you hold on to and attach to these grounds for views, it leads to such and such a destiny in the next life. He understands this and what goes beyond this, in other words, the Buddha. Yet, since he does not misapprehend that understanding, he has realized extinguishment within himself. Having truly understood the origin, ending, gratification, drawback, and escape from feelings, the realized one is freed through not grasping. So what is going on here? Yeah, this may seem a bit baffling to you when you see this. If you thought what was seen so far was baffling, there's even more baffling. So these are the four views. And if you hold on to this, the Buddha says, it leads to such and such a destiny in the next life. In other words, these views, they have a result, yeah? And the result is that, at the very least, you will get reborn. Yeah, these views do not stop you from getting reborn, because these views, they have a... That's what they do, these views. If you think of an eternal self, there is a craving there to exist that comes with that eternal self, yeah? You want to exist in that way. You have seen yourself, you think you know that you exist in a certain way, and because of that you will also crave for that. And that craving, even though it may temporarily disappear in deep samadhi, it is there underlying your whole experience. And so in that underlying craving, whatever that might be, that will drive the rebirth process and will project you into the future. So all of these things have craving coming with them. When you have these views, especially because they are not based on an experience of reality, there will be a degree of grasping them, of holding on to them. Yeah. So the Buddha says that evang paramatta, says the Pali, evangahita, in other words, held in this way, grasped in this way, there is a degree of grasping and holding on that comes from that craving, which goes with all of these views. None of these views are freed from that. To be freed from that craving and grasping, you have to actually see things according to reality. Yeah, this is what Buddha says. You cannot see things in the wrong way, because that seeing in the wrong way will always have an aspect of craving and grasping coming with it. It is based on the delusion of something inside, and that delusion is not real. Sometimes that delusion will be challenged, and when that delusion is challenged, that is when you will feel the grasping, and you will see yourself clinging, because you're not able to let go. Yeah, so these things are always challenged. The reason why these views are challenged is because if you say, well, this is the real me, wow, I've experienced this beautiful state of samadhi, wow, so powerful, that is the real me. And then you can't go back there. Yeah, you're not able to reattain that state. And then you start to wonder, maybe it isn't the real me. Yeah, how do I know it is the real me? And then you feel the grasping to that state, wanting to go back there, not being able to do it. And you can see how you hold on to these things without actually, you know, because of the uncertainty and unreliability of this. So all of these things are grasped. And then depending on how they are grasped, your rebirth will then depend on how you grasp them, on the extent to which you are able to achieve these states, the extent to which you live well, and all of these other factors will then come together with that view to decide how you get reborn. But they will always lead to rebirth. Views, wrong views, will always lead to rebirth. So they are grasped in this way, attached to her. And so the Buddha understands that. He understands the fact that these things lead to rebirth. And then he also understands what goes beyond. And what goes beyond is giving up those grasping to those views. In fact, giving up those views altogether, not just the grasping, but also giving up the view themselves. Because he knows that those views actually don't really match reality. And then, because he understands that, of course, you don't grasp it anymore, because you know it is wrong, so you let go of the grasping. And when you let go of all grasping to views, then you are extinguished within yourself. Pachatang Nibbuti. We have a monk in a monastery called Nibbuto. That's his name. Nibbuti, same word. Extinguished inside. In other words, you have attained Nibbana inside. You don't hold on to any views anymore. And then comes the interesting point. What about the Buddha? Doesn't he have a view? He does have a view. And this is when you are a stream entry, you're called ditti patto. Ditti is view. Patto means attained. So you are attained to view. The difference is you don't grasp those views. And the reason you don't grasp them is because you know that they are true. You have seen these things to such a profound way that you know that these things are true. You don't need to grasp them anymore. And that is the difference between the puttujana, the ordinary person, and the noble one. Is that the puttujana must grasp because the view is wrong, whereas the Aryan, the noble one, does not grasp. Because they know this is true. So even the right, even though an Arya has a right view, they don't grasp that right view. If you are a non-Arya, like most people, even if you are a Buddhist, you're going to grasp your views. To some extent, you may say, Buddhism is the best. Yay, Buddhism. But you are going to grasp that view of yay, Buddhism, to some extent. It may be right in a certain way, but because you haven't seen it fully through your own insight, you're going to grasp it. And that's okay. It's okay to grasp those views a little bit. In fact, you have no choice but to grasp them, because that's what the sense of self does. It grasps onto these things. So for all of us, or for all those people who are not Aryans, the grasping is going to happen to some extent. Whether it is you are a Buddhist or you are a non-Buddhist or whatever, it's going to happen. Hopefully, we are grasping onto something which will ultimately lead to non-grasping. That is the difference. There are certain views that don't ultimately lead to non-grasping. Like these particular views here. And there are other views like, but hopefully right, if you practice the Noble Eightfold Path and you follow the teaching of the Buddha, hopefully down the track they will lead to non-grasping. And then you start to hopefully eventually see what the Buddha himself saw. Does it make sense? Please, Huitong.
Ajahn, I know that's... To say that making a bet is not right because there's no self there herein, right? So the only understanding that I can come to is that it's my natural affinity to the Lord Buddha himself that just flocked to this teaching.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's not something that I can control whatsoever.
Yeah. 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 It is your natural affinity. It is your, that's part of it. It is maybe because you actually carefully considered various paths, there's no self, but there is still careful consideration, which is non-self. Non-self careful consideration, they're still there. So some people are more careful with how they consider things by nature than other people are. So that could be part of your conditioning, that you consider things more carefully. There are some people who don't really have time to consider religious questions very much. And I always find it fascinating. Some of the people who are really intelligent in the world, yeah, they don't really have time to think about religious questions, yeah, and then they kind of just grasp onto something. So intelligence is not always doesn't always go together with wisdom. These things are often quite separate. And you can be a very simple person with no education, a very simple life, and yet you have that kind of mind which kind of leans in the right direction. So wisdom is quite different in Buddhism from intelligence. They don't always match together in that way. So I'm making the distinction here between view and attachment to views. Yeah, and this is an important distinction in Buddhism, and it is the ideally, when you are an Arya, you have views. Yeah, the Buddha has views, but they are no longer attached to those views. And that is really the problem, is the attachment to views. But still, don't give up that attachment until you are ready. It is important, you know, we have to have some attachments early on. There's no choice about it. So even though you attach a little bit to the views of whatever it is, that's okay. But don't attach too much, yeah? Because if you attach too much, you end up arguing with people. The Buddha, he didn't know anything. What? You can't say that? You terrible person, yeah? That's kind of what you become. And you become very defensive because someone challenged you on something that you think is very important. Ah, there is no rebirth. Yeah, rubbish. What do you mean there's no rebirth? Rubbish. Yeah, and again, okay, whatever. Yeah, fine. You know, you don't believe in rebirth. No worries. That's your, you know, that's your problem. No, whatever. Yeah. Yeah, he did, yes. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes he did, yeah. It's not so much that the Buddha entered the debate, it's more like he was approached by others, yeah, yeah. But yes, he did, and then they had a debate, and then, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, if someone wants to debate and they came here and then we could, you know, maybe, I don't think anyone wants to debate with us, to be honest, I doubt it. But I'm certainly not going to go out there and debate. I remember many years ago, we had a very interesting thing. We had Ajahn Brahm was invited to give the sermon in the Perth Cathedral, yeah, on St. George's Terrace. Was anyone here there when that happened? Yeah, oh, you were there, Lynn? That was back in the late 90s, maybe? Anyway, it's a long time ago now, 20 years ago or something. And he gave a sermon in St. George's. I must admit, first of all, I'm very impressed with the Anglican Church who actually would allow that. Yeah, very open-minded of them to do that. So he gave the sermon in there, and they had, I don't think they ever had such a big crowd in St. George's in the cathedral because he was there. But that was interesting. That was a little bit like that, yeah, because Ajahn Brahm was very rounded in the way he formed. He didn't kind of challenge very much, of course. When you are invited like that, you have to be careful. But that was a little bit like that, yeah, coming together from different religions. And we have also had the dean of St. George's Cathedral, John Shepherd, he was here. He's retired now and gave a talk here. So we have also done similar kind of things. But we haven't really had any kind of out-and-out fist fights over what is right and what is wrong. Yeah. Okay. So let's just finish this off. So, yeah, so you are extinguished within yourself, and you don't misapprehend that understanding of the views. You don't hold on to it, yeah. Actually, misapprehend is not really good, because what it really means, you don't hold on to it. Na paramasati doesn't mean misapprehend, it means you don't hold on, yeah. You don't grasp anymore. That's really what it means. And then he says, having truly understood the origin, ending, gratification, drawback, and escape from feelings, the realized one is freed through not grasping. And this is kind of strange. What has this got to do with what we have just seen? What has feelings got to do with all of this? And this is really what is kind of very interesting with this whole way that this is explained, is that the reason why we have views is usually based on feelings. Why do we have views about anything? Why do you have political views? Yeah. Well, very often it's because we grew up in a certain way, or we had friends in a certain way, or our parents said a certain thing. Either we agree with our parents, or we are perhaps in opposition to our parents. Yeah. But somehow we are conditioned into those views, and those views feel right to us. They feel good. That's very often why we have those views. So feeling is one of the principal reasons why we have views. it's actually very interesting, because very often we take ourselves to be rational people. I'm rational, yeah? My view is right. I believe in this kind of politics because this is the right way of running the blooming country. And these scallywags don't know what they're doing. This is the right view or whatever. But the reason we say is often not so much, there is of course some degree of logic there, but the root reason is feeling. It feels right in a certain way. And all of these views that we are seeing here, the view of eternalism, it tends to feel right. Why? Because you already feel like you have a self. Yeah, we all have this feeling of me being somebody. I am someone. And the moment someone says that you will last for eternity, you go to Brahma and you will bliss out forever, it sounds incredibly attractive to the vast majority of people. Just the theory makes you happy. Yay! God, happiness forever after. Wow, I really want that. And not just small happiness, big time happiness for eternity. I could do with that. And then you believe it because it feels good and not because you really have fully understood what is going on. And this is very, very profound. Once you understand that your views are largely based on feeling, why do we come to the Buddhist society? Why do people become Buddhist monks? Yeah? Pretty weird, right? Becoming a Buddhist monk. Maybe not for you guys, but for many people it's really strange. But a lot of this initially has to do with feeling. It feels right, and some degree of understanding the suttas and some degree of logic on top of that. Yeah, things coming together here. But once you understand that these feelings are unreliable, and this is what the Buddha is saying here, yeah, these feelings are, they have an origin, they have an ending, they have a gratification, there's something good about them, there's a drawback and there's an escape. Once you understand the problem with these feelings, that they are based on contact, we'll see this later on in the sutta, they're based on the view coming together, feeling that view, and once you cannot hold on to that view anymore, once that view is challenged, once you forget about that view, the feeling is also gone. You cannot sustain that happy feeling based on that view. And then you start to understand that actually this is all very dodgy. Yeah, there's nothing really here which I... All of this is really kind of not worth holding on to at all. I just had to let go of everything because none of that is stable. None of that is has any real value because it all depends on certain conditions to arise. Take away those conditions, everything falls apart. So this is what the Buddha is saying here, yeah? That these views and these feelings go together and all of it is unreliable and uncertain. It is not worth holding on to. You've got to go deeper. And that, of course, is exactly what the Buddha does. He goes even deeper. And he finds the what goes beyond those views. And that is exactly what the Buddha's teaching is about. So then he says, once you do that, then the Buddha is freed. Yeah, the Blessed One, the real one, is freed through not grasping. There's nothing to be grasped anymore in all of existence. And that is the highest liberation. And that is the kind of liberation which is irreversible, according to the Buddha. These are the principles, deep, hard to see. Yeah, you can really see that this is pretty profound, hard to understand, peaceful, sublime, beyond the scope of reason, subtle, comprehensible to the astute, which the realized one, the Buddha, makes known after realizing them with his own insight. And those who genuinely praise the realized one would rightly speak of these things. So, any questions? Yes, Niklas. You can use two, yeah.
Sorry, just going back to dependent origination again, you're saying that delusion could basically exist as itself for a long time. Did I understand that correctly? Its own entity, essentially?
It cannot exist by itself in that sense. It must always exist as part of the five aggregates, yeah?
Right.
But delusion is self-perpetuating. So once the five aggregates are deluded, they will tend to be deluded also in the future. So within the structure of the five aggregates, delusion is self-perpetuating. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All
right. Thank you.
Yeah. Anyone else want to say anything here? Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Isn't it kind of fascinating, this stuff? I just find this really, really cool. I hope you agree with me, otherwise have some trouble. But I find it's very fascinating. This is kind of really Buddhism in a very deep way, yeah? These views and delusion, understanding reality, and it kind of compares Buddhism to other teachings, and this reason is very fascinating. I did mention at the beginning there about Advaita Vedanta, because there are many people who say that Advaita Vedanta and Buddhism are the same. Yeah, this idea that there is a mind or an eternal self, a Brahma behind everything. Yeah? But right here the Buddha says basically this is wrong view. The idea that there is a Brahma which is always there is based on feelings. It feels nice, yeah? I want to be there forever after, yay, with Brahma. Hang out with Brahma until the end of eternity. Actually, eternity doesn't come to an end, so that's kind of an oxymoron. But, yeah? So, and of course, that's what the Buddha is saying here. So actually, this idea that somehow Advaita Vedanta and Buddhism are the same, it is undermined by this very teaching here, and also more teachings coming later on in this particular sutta. So it shows the difference here between some of the most profound of outside teachings. Yeah? Advaita Vedanta in many ways is a very profound teaching, yeah? But the Buddha shows the limits of even that, which is fascinating. Yeah? But so let's have a look at some of the questions outside. The question from Indonesia. Dear Ajahn, at what point when you finally have this light bulb moment, but you're finally 100% sure that you have gained the right view just like the Buddha? At what point can you be absolutely sure that you have gained the right view just like the Buddha? This is can be very hard to know, and it's very easy to be deluded about this. There is a large number of people wandering on this planet who think that they are Sri Mentors or even Arahants. If you go on the internet and you search for certain people, it has the name of the person, and then it has the Arahant afterwards, yeah? In other words, I'm an Arahant, yeah? And then they will say, yeah, I became an Arahant, you know, and actually it wasn't all that interesting, yeah, and then now I kind of live my ordinary life, I go to work, you know, and I kind of, you know, my wife is still around, you know, and I kind of do the, or it wasn't, you know, being an Arahant is pretty cool, but it's not kind of that special, yeah? And you get these kind of things, yeah, and this is what people sometimes say, but so it is very, very easy to be deluded by these things, very easy to get it wrong. These are really profound things. And if you become a stream entry, it is like a revolution in consciousness. It is like everything in the world is pretty much turned upside down. You look at things in an absolutely new way. And if you have that kind of experience, it will be something that lasts, goes with you. The bliss of that insight will kind of go on for 3 days or something like that. Yeah, it will be that powerful, and you will never ever forget where that happened, because it will be like what Ajahn Brahm says, a positive trauma. It will be a trauma that is so powerful but so positive that you will never be able to forget it. So it's very, so that is gives you some indication, yeah, about whether you have got there or not. But really, the only thing you can really know is when you become an Arahant, when you become fully awakened. And the reason you can know that, because then you know through direct experience that you will have no rebirth. Yeah? So only when you know with absolute certainty inside of you that you will not get reborn again through your own insight, when you know that, then you can be absolutely sure that you are fully awakened and enlightened. Until then, be careful. Speak with people who you have confidence in, who might be able to guide you in the right way. Come and have a chat with Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, say to Ajahn Brahm, wow, I had this experience. Am I a stream mentor? Ajahn Brahm will say, maybe, maybe not. Yeah, he will have a good chat with you anyway, and then he will sort of suss you out and see whether you are on the right track or not. But even Ajahn Brahm will not be able to tell you for sure. Yeah, in the end, you have to find out for yourself what is going on. But be very, very careful. We're not overestimating yourself. The problem with overestimating yourself, if you get it wrong, is that you block the path to awakening once you overestimate yourself. So better to underestimate than to overestimate. Okay. Then we have a question from Perth. How does Hyperionism worldview fit in the suttas, i.e. that material reality is a myth and that we all exist in a shared dream? It says mind is eternal and is the true reality. It says current science has it wrong because it takes matter to be real and mind to be the product of matter, when actually the opposite is true. Okay, I'm not familiar with the term Hyperionism, but what I can say is that the idea that the matter is the ultimate reality does not fit with a Buddhist viewpoint. Yeah, from a Buddhist point of view, it is much more correct to say that mind is the ultimate reality and mind is prior to matter. That is much more what the Buddhist view is. I think that is, you know, so what exactly, how far should we take that view and et cetera? It is, I think, uncertain to, you know, is matter a byproduct of the mind? I would say probably is, yeah, in a certain way. Matter is just a perception, it's a way of seeing the world. And mind is definitely prior in terms of Buddhism, and the matter is secondary. Mind is what drives the world. And it kind of makes really good sense when you think about it, yeah? I mean, what is the first thing that we have is experience. Nothing comes before experience. And then the idea of matter, of electrons, of charges and this kind of stuff, it's a derived thing that comes from our experience. But our experience is primary. It makes very good sense to think that matter is more fundamental, and that all the material stuff is just a secondary thing derived from our primary experience. So I think that makes sense. Whether this particular view, Hyperionism, is right, I don't know. I would have to have a look at it, but to see exactly what it is saying. But it sounds close to the truth, I would say. But the problem, of course, is that there are many views of thinking about the world as mental, which may be wrong. Just because you think the world is mental may be right in some ways, it might be wrong in other ways. You can see the mental aspect as eternal again, or something like that, and then you have a problem. Then we have a question from the United States. One more question from America. Well, we haven't had the first one yet, so what do you mean one more? Anyway, we'll just go with this one. If there is no self, but we can recall our past lives, at some point of mastery, can we also recall other people's past lives? Or are they not just as much ours? Is this not how monks read minds? Understanding that nothing inside the mind is personal, then nothing in another mind is theirs either and can be accessed with the right view. The point is that there is something, you know, you have this idea of a stream of consciousness. And the stream of consciousness goes from one life to the next one, yeah, moving from one life to the next one. And because there is a stream, there is a certain continuity there. Yeah, this is the important point. There is continuity. That's why you think of yourself when I was young. Yeah, this well, that was I was there. And you can see how there is a continuity from when you were young to where you are now. Yeah, there's a certain continuity. And that continuity, you don't have that with someone else. Yeah, that there is a separation there. And it is because of that continuity, because of that stream of consciousness moving from one life to the next one, that's why you can remember your past lives. And you cannot really remember another person's past lives. You can read their mind, that's true. So you can, you know, potentially anyway, you can read people's minds. But that is now, that is what they have in their mind now. You cannot really read someone's mind in the past life unless they are recalling their past lives. Maybe you can ask someone, say, okay, recall your past life, and then I will read your mind. And then I will see, maybe you can do that. But that kind of gets a bit complicated. So I would say normally you cannot do that, but you might be able through inference to maybe see your friends in the past life, yeah, and see and maybe see that they are still your friends in this life, yeah. Maybe we were mates in the past life, I don't know. Maybe, yeah. It is quite possible that people who are together in this life were friends in the past life. It's quite possible, maybe even likely, because there is a reason why we get attracted, why we are in the same place, because we are attracted to many of the same things, to Buddha's teachings and all of these kind of things. But basically, no, I don't think you can remember other people's past lives, but you certainly can remember your own. Yeah.
But
evolved, right? We changed, you know, did this and then get into the rut.
Yeah.
That way, and therefore
they could, but I think that was more often more on just observing them in the here and now, yeah, and see what they were doing, how that was leading on. I don't know. I must admit, I'm a little bit. It's a little bit hard to. I'm not 100% sure about this, to be honest with you. But maybe they are able to somehow infer things about the past. But they certainly can't read it directly in the same way that you can read your own life, which you can read directly. There would be some kind of inference there, or some kind of non-direct way of seeing it. I would think. Yeah. Oh, okay. Are you all exhausted? Yeah, I'm feeling a bit exhausted myself. Okay, if there are no more questions, let's call it a day. Let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.